Your name?
Alan Asserson.
Alan Asserson, you were, as of a few weeks ago, we would have said you are, but now we say you were a parent. You still are a parent of a DCPS student, but one of your kids has left Hardy Middle School, where you as a parent have put a lot of time and energy in. And there's been a lot of controversy surrounding Hardy, and you've been at the front and center of dealing with some of Michelle Reed's actions. And, well, she quote-unquote promoted the principal, Patrick Pope, to a school that doesn't exist. And what was left over has been not ideal and, in fact, may have led to your pulling your child. But go into some detail about Hardy.
Yeah, Hardy Middle School is represented by every ward in the city in terms of its population. It's pretty evenly distributed. It's in Ward 2 on Wisconsin Avenue, essentially. And it's been a highly successful middle school. And for our family, it was a great school and a school that we had the option of avoiding if we wanted to. It was our choice. The transition that the chancellor has imposed on the school was done against the wishes of the teachers, the families, and the students almost unanimously, not 100%, but pretty close as you can get. And the result has been not a very smooth transition. As opposed to children who are in Ward 7 and 8, 5, that are really making the big sacrifice to drive or to take public transportation to get to school and to come back at the end of the day, most of those families don't have choices because the schools in their neighborhoods are just not adequate for their families or for any children. That we shouldn't be pretending that there's inequality in the public school system. There isn't. And that's one of the attractiveness, attractive features of Hardy is it's such a supremely high-achieving school. And families like myself and another LSRT, which is the local school restructuring team, and PTA member, Carson Oblander, and I went to the last moment, and both of us took our children out of the school because of the unrest and the difficulties that they're having there now. We have the option to leave, and those families don't.
I was around Hardy, and I stepped outside, and a security guard said, "Oh, are you here about the principal? This is the end of last year, Patrick Pope." And she said, I said, "Yeah, I'm here about that." And she volunteered, didn't ask her. Well, he's the type of person who gives up money for a kid to help them catch a bus ride home. And as you're saying, Hardy really represents this city, and yet it didn't see this achievement gap. It was a very high-achieving, year-in, year-out school, a principal who was on point, who has now been promoted to a school that doesn't exist. And this has created an atmosphere where you have now pulled your child out.
Right. Well, the proposed Magnet Arts Middle School that he's being pushed into taking this planning position is now supposed to start in the 2011 and 2012 year. There's no real education-based need for it. There's no demand that can be demonstrated. We've always asked the DCPS to provide an executive summary or any other information. What they have produced is this cavalcade of stars. It's more of a political, list of artists, musicians, people in the theater that would be contributing parts, and part of a board of directors for the school. That sounds great, but without the nuts and bolts and the facility and the money, is, the final straw. It's not there. And with all the needs that there are for public schools in the city, and the fact that we are fiscally strapped because of the recession that the area is under, we're nobody's really taking this as a serious venture, and nobody has confidence that this is something that they can depend on. What they have felt is that this was a political way in which they could take a popular principal but unpopular to the chancellor's office because he was a old school educator, very accomplished, but also somebody that had very strong ideas about how he wanted to run the school. And the fact that he didn't necessarily agree with the imposition of things like programs like capital gains, which pays children to go to school, or other programs of reform under Rhee that he felt would destabilize the school, meant that he soon became somebody that they wanted to replace.
You mentioned that you're very fortunate and you live where a lot of resources have been put towards the public schools, but you mentioned other parts of the city where the schools aren't adequate. Can you, from your perspective, though, this still upsets you, this tale of two cities, really, when it comes to educating the children in the District of Columbia?
Yes. I mean, this is really not a knock so much on great schools. I mean, there's fabulous schools in Washington, and people shouldn't look at DCPS and say it's a failure in regard to schools like Wilson or Alice Deal Middle School or Key Elementary, which I have another child in. It's a fantastic school. The real problem and the real failure is an assumption and a policy by the chancellor to develop a neighborhood school concentration where we're putting the best students, the most affluent families in schools, and then we're creating the expectation that just by putting in great teachers and good administrators, and we're going to make schools in these poverty and other family issues inhibited schools successful. It's the bedrock of her educational philosophy that human capital, as she calls it, is the major factor towards a school's success. And it's not borne out by any respected educational data that this is the case. If that was the case, she could have transferred all the successful teachers from these very high-performing schools in Northwest and then sent them to Southeast, and we would have been done with this problem. But she's never really had the courage to test her own theory. And there is, I think, the proof that actually she's aware of some of the she's aware of the weakness of the theory, but it's been a political saleable policy to communities that want to compete in Northwest, for instance, with private schools. The schools that I mentioned are schools in public schools in Northwest that people choose over private schools, especially now that the economy is becoming more difficult. The public school option is something that young families are considering more and more.
Alan Asserson, the gaps between black and white, between low-income and not low-income students in D.C. is some of the widest in the country, and in fact has, in some instances, gotten wider under Michelle Rhee's tenure. And yet, we don't read about this in the Washington Post, not consistently. What we read about is that this is about school reform, and maybe it's going too fast for some people, but it's all about reform, and reform's a good thing. It needs to happen. Does the Washington Post, is it an objective, nonpartisan news source when it comes to commenting on education issues?
Well, I mean, as some people know, the Washington Post company owns Kaplan Incorporated, which is the largest for-profit education entity in the world. They are an international group. Their interest in the private schools and other education services certainly is a potential conflict of interest. But you know, there's a philosophy towards spending money and where your income is going to get in public schools that also potentially is going to be advantageous to companies like Kaplan, depending on what, you know, or the Washington Post. So in particular with the education issue, the Post has been extremely supportive of Rhee in general and her reform policies. The problem I have with the reform policies is they're not based on really any kind of accepted educational philosophy. I've been doing a lot of work with people up at Columbia University Teachers College in New York and other people just trying to verify the socio economic factors that are involved in successful school systems. They all argue that high concentrations of poverty and family instability are the absolute greatest contributors towards predicting whether children are going to succeed or fail, and that the only really successful approaches, let's just say for the moment, we don't want busing, but to create magnet schools and other ways in which we reduce these concentrations, schools like Hardy, which through their arts program, it's not a magnet school, but it is a special school. There's a special classification for it, where they are really able to not cherry pick students. They take a lot of kids that are significantly below grade level. The great thing about that school is, even though those kids are coming from Ward 7 and 8 and 5 and 4 or just from distressed neighborhoods, these kids are finding a way to achieve. Their value added from 6th grade to 8th is the best in the city. And there's a reason for that. And when we have high concentrations, it's been shown, there's a study, many studies by a professor, David Belliner at Arizona State University, that show that when you have very high achieving students in very high socioeconomic, where the average student is from a high socioeconomic status, those kids do great. If you transplant those same students to a school with lower socioeconomic status, they don't do nearly as well. Your peer group means a lot. The same can be said for a poor student who's transferred to a very high socioeconomic status, average, you know, population. Those kids all of a sudden start doing well. But the greatest tragedy is when you look at those poor kids that are stuck in those poor schools, and those kids, it's a double X. It's two strikes, and there's really almost no chance. Teachers won't help. Throwing money at it won't help. What it is that we have to look at public schools in the way that public schools, I believe, should be, is that it's a public responsibility that we try to create opportunity for everybody in the public school system.
Alan Asherson, while the party line for the Washington Post has been very much pro Michelle Rhee and her so-called school reforms, there have been moments where columnists, like, for example, Colby King, in an August 21st column, he wrote, quote, the achievement gap between the district's poorest and its most affluent has, in some cases, widened. So too, the black-white gulf. The achievement gaps go to the heart of school reform efforts. Rhee believes, almost as an article of faith, that the teacher is key to student achievement, and she has turned the school system upside down trying to make that point. There is, of course, a contrary view that the teacher, while crucial, cannot get the job done without the support of a solid principal and a home that sends a child to school ready to learn, end quote. And I think that what you're pointing out, what Colby King is pointing out, is that there have to be factors other than just the classroom that are considered when talking about education. We need to talk about poverty. We need to talk about access to all sorts of things and not just focus on, you know, impact evaluations, which focus on the teachers, if the kid has three disruptions in an hour, whatever it is, that's a bad teacher. But we need to really broaden our perspective of education.
Yeah, I think that's, and I don't want to focus only on, I think Cobra King is correct, but we don't even have to focus only on poor performing schools in poor neighborhoods. We can look at our best performing schools and our wealthiest neighborhoods and see how impact in this data-driven school chancellor's decision-making has pushed accountability to the point where it's not just punishing teachers. I mean, it's a culture of fear and competition between teachers, which is so discouraging of collaboration and inspirational thought. The amount of testing that these kids go into means that students are missing between 6 and 8 weeks of instruction a year that could be put towards really critical thinking and other inspirational type of self-discovery. That's is really what education is about. The nuts and bolts is our tools that we use to, you know, of education, whether it be math and science, to produce things of value and understanding of value. But they in themselves are not really what the best schools in this city are striving for. You don't see people at Sidwell Friends School or St. Albans with this testing regimen. And if put installing IMPACT and all of these other important metric systems of accountability are going to be creating a culture of fear of failure, our children will not succeed.
Alan Asterson, I wanted to finish again with the Washington Post. There was a article by Andrew Alexander, the ombudsman, August 22nd, and it's entitled From Kaplan to Buffett, The Post Hides Little. And it reads, quote, "But the disclosure of the Post Company's ownership of Kaplan is especially critical because of Kaplan's outsized importance to the overall bottom line. The Kaplan division, which offers higher education, test preparation, and professional training services, accounted for 62% of the Post Company's total second quarter revenues. Its higher education unit, the subject of government scrutiny and proposed regulations, will be in the news for months to come." Continuing, "I've often criticized the Post for insufficient transparency on everything from news sources to refusing to share its ethics policies with readers, but on its commitment to disclose self-interest, praise is deserved," end quote. Your response to this article from Andrew Alexander, the ombudsman, with regards to what the Post, he says they're doing a really good job with their disclosure.
Well, it was nice that somebody said somebody finally, but when you look at the Washington Post, the only times you ever actually heard about the relationship was on their online section where bloggers would continually bring the point up. And I think that, you know, withering under the, you know, continued, you know, vigilance of a lot of people online that were, you know, repeating this over and over again, perhaps the Post has accepted some conflict of interest. But Donald Graham is a member of the board, I believe, of KIPP. He's obviously, you know, on the board of directors of Kaplan.
And he's the chairman of the Washington Post.
And he's the chairman of the Washington Post, Catherine Graham's son. And this is the only profit-making portion of the business at this point. You know, their stock has been taking big hits because of new federal regulation that's going to be calling into question schools like Kaplan, where their students are repaying a very small proportion of their student loans. And this is something that, you know, the education business is huge money. I mean, Jeb Bush in Florida, I mean, there's a lot of proponents of private education. In fact, there's a push a lot of people fear in Newark, New Jersey. The new governor, the Republican governor there, Christie, is basically come to an agreement with Clifford Janey, the former superintendent of schools for Washington, that he would leave and they would not he wouldn't fulfill his last year of his contract. But a lot of people in the know are in the belief that he is looking towards really privatizing and selling contracts for a lot of the functions for the public school system there in Newark. I don't know if that's what Ree and the Washington Post had in mind for Washington, D.C., but from all of the you know, reform moves that have been made, it would hard to be argued that it was in some way prohibiting that. It was certainly encouraging, you know, the idea that through all the metrics and all the other programs would be involved, that putting money and a business model of education in place, teacher accountability, you know, it's almost as if these teachers are like salesmen. If they don't make their quota, which in terms of students, we'll find another person to fill your place. Teacher's experience really was considered something she didn't feel was very important. In fact, she said many times that she doesn't understand why anybody would consider education a career. These are not the kind of statements that you want to make. And then also to be able to say that we're attracting the best qualified people from around the country to come to Washington and teach. Because nobody who has a secure or good job, who's a principal or a teacher in another school system, is going to come to Washington at this point. Her reputation is well understood, and it's almost all of the people, the new hires, of either Teach for America or young people now, or people that are recently displaced in neighboring school systems.
Alan Asterson, I think the amount of money that is in education, I was startled when I started reading about Kaplan and the Washington Post. The revenue, the 2009 revenue for Kaplan is $2.6 billion, and it's expected to exceed $3 billion for 2010. And so the Post, one media critic said, you know, if you just took the Washington Post out of the name of the company, that would be a little bit more honest. And so it is this massive education component, which is really, despite Andrew Alexander's, the ombudsman's article, it's really not disclosed, certainly not consistently, and yet the Post is constantly writing about this issue. And on the issue of Kaplan taking a hit and being investigated by the federal government, this is not insignificant for this company. I wanted to read a couple of sentences from an article in The Examiner by Leah Fable, August 16, 2010, entitled Post Hit as Feds Target For-Profit Colleges. It reads, quote, "The Washington Post company took a hit Monday on news that for-profit colleges run by the company's cash cow, Kaplan Incorporated, would face severe restrictions under new rules from the Department of Education. Kaplan, responsible for 67% of the Post company's $92 million in second quarter earnings, runs dozens of for-profit colleges nationwide, as well as pricey test preparation classes and books. The company's colleges, as well as hundreds of others throughout the nation, are under fire from the Department of Education for saddling students with debt loads without concern about whether they will be able to pay it back. Shares of the Post tumbled 8% to $315.65 on the news as stocks of for-profit colleges nationwide plunged. The Department of Education estimated that only 28% of former Kaplan students are repaying their loans, compared with 36% at for-profit colleges nationwide and 54% at public universities nationwide. Continuing, under the new rules, most schools that fail to have a 45% of their former students in repayment would not be fully eligible for federal funds. They would be subject to limits on enrollment and enrollment growth and would need to demonstrate employer support for their academic programs." End quote. That from The Examiner by Leah Fable, Post Hit as Feds Target For-Profit Colleges. This, in fact, could be a major blow to the Washington Post company, which then turned around in an editorial and slammed the idea of the federal government looking into them.
I mean, the article pretty much speaks for itself. I mean, I don't think in that article they made too big a point about their conflict of interest. I did mention it, but it's the most important portion of the Kaplan business, and the biggest profit-making portions of it are ones in which they don't have students who are able to take the degrees they're getting and able to convert it into marketable jobs. So a lot of people that have been working for Kaplan, either as instructors and that are disgruntled perhaps, but have described Kaplan in not all their divisions, so all the smaller divisions, as diploma mills. And you don't have to watch TV for more than 5 minutes to see a program on a educational opportunity for you to take classes in right now. This is big business. When it comes to the other portions of the media that the Washington Post are involved in, television, radio, and in print, most recently, I mean, neither the Washington Post or Newsweek were making money for years. They just sold Newsweek to Jane Harman, Congresswoman Jane Harman's husband, who owns Harman Industries, for a dollar, because there's $160 million in liabilities at Newsweek. Now, I think it's great that Newsweek is going to survive and it's going to have a philanthropist, you know, that is going to be able to bring it along. You know, journalism is a difficult business to make money in, but education clearly is one in which they've found their survival in. It's hard to imagine when you're in a survival mode like this that the Washington Post can be anything more than doing what most corporate entities would be, is trying to protect the interests of their shareholders. That's their fiduciary responsibility.
And that was very clear in an editorial on the backside of the piece by Andrew Alexander, the ombudsman, about how we disclose everything. They finally did disclose make a significant disclosure in one of their editorials. And the editorial is entitled, How to Discourage College Students, Choice Matters in Higher Education Too. And it reads, quote, the Obama administration is considering rules that could sharply limit the availability of for-profit colleges to American students. The government is right to fashion reasonable regulation to discourage fraud or misleading practices. But it would be wrong to impose rules that remove an option that is especially useful for poor and working students. Readers should know that we have a conflict of interest regarding this subject. The Washington Post Company, which owns the Post newspaper and WashingtonPost.com, also owns Kaplan University and other for-profit schools of higher education that, according to company officials, could be harmed by the proposed regulations, end quote. So you're talking about protecting, you know, stockholders and getting the highest return on investment. And here they are openly using editorials to call on the Obama administration not to launch any real hard-hitting investigation into the fact that you have these for-profit colleges, in particular Kaplan, where students are only paying, only 28% of students are able to pay back any of their loans. At least in this instance, they disclose that, in fact, readers should know that we have a conflict of interest regarding this subject. But you rarely hear the, in fact, I can't remember another time where you read those words in the Washington Post.
Yeah, the problem with it is those words were preceded by them saying that this was going to hurt the opportunities for the poor and people who are underprivileged, which is just so disheartening to hear, because I don't think any credible person who understands the business of education thinks that that is what they're really concerned about at all. I mean, this is what's the problem with school reform in a lot of urban areas, including Washington and with Chancellor Rhee. She's consistently hiding behind the pants and skirts of the children in terms of defending their ability to get a good education. But her policies have really widened the achievement gap. They've certainly done some good things. I mean, it's not an entirely, you know, one-sided story. But this lack of wanting to have a true discussion, a true debate about what are the real motivations is always upset me, and I know a lot of other people who've been involved in education for a long time. It's disingenuous.
Any final thoughts you want to share?
I thank you for the opportunity, and I hope that people understand that there's a lot of motivated people that believe in school reform in this city. School reform is an essential thing that isn't a welfare program for poor kids on the other side of the river, but it is something in which we all need to understand better and become more informed about what the differences are and what the purpose and kind of reestablish a good understanding of what the purposes of public education is.
Thanks, Alan Asserson.
Thank you.